You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Mike Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today I'm in the studio with what for me is a very special guest, someone who I've been looking forward to meeting and speaking to for a long time. His name is Oliver Sacks. His most recent book from the University of California Press is Seeing Voices, subtitled A Journey into the World of the Deaf. And his previous books are The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, A Leg to Stand On, Awakenings, and his first book, a book on migraine, which I think was also published by the University of California, if I'm correct. These books have been, I think, humanizing influences on their reader. In them, I find a sense of wonder at the fact of life itself, at, you know, the mere fact that life exists. And with it, coupled a sense of gratitude. It is not surprising, then, to know that his early work, a book on the dreams of people who had African sleeping sickness, as it was called, that the early work was praised by W.H. Auden. I think it's a poetic vision which poets look to for inspiration. Every once in a while, there'll be a book, you know, that we share mostly with poet friends. I know that Marion Moore loved Adelbart Stifter's novella, The Rock Crystal, because of its accuracy in describing minerals. And it's that sense of life going on even at its furthest extremes that I value in the work of Oliver Sacks. It's very nice to have you here.
Very nice to be here.
The new book, Seeing Voices, A Journey into the World of the Deaf, what led you to the deaf?
Well, it's been an odd business because previously I'd always been led by my own experience. And this time I was led by another book, by being sent Harlan Lane's book, When the Mind Hears, to review. And up to that time, I'd never thought about what it might be to be deaf, or to have a separate language. And I don't think I'd ever met a deaf person. But Lane's book filled me with astonishment and wonder, and also with an urge to go out and see for myself. And so my own journey started then.
You reveal in the book something that is known to many in the deaf community, but may not be known outside it, that sign is a language. That is to say, according to Chomsky's definition, a language is capable of generating previously unmade truthful statements in itself following a set of given grammatical rules, and that sign by now is a language that does that, that it is clinically, definably a language.
Well, yes, in some sense, certainly deaf people themselves who create sign languages wherever they are. There's no universal sign language. There are hundreds of them. In some sense, they've always known that. But there's also been a strong feeling among others that sign is just a pantomime or broken English on the hands, or as one Encyclopedia Britannica put it, a species of picture writing in the air. And it was only in 1960, really very late, that Stokey, who was a great linguist at Gallaudet College, this unique college for the deaf, it was only in 1960 that Stokey was able to prove the sublexical structure of signs, that there can be 50 or 60 different phonemes or phonemic elements in them, and that there's a very intricate spatial grammar and syntax, and that, as you say, one can make any proposition which speech can make. And even so, this has been somewhat slow to be accepted.
Yes, and important, I think most people think of sign as being simply a language that exists for translation. In other words, it's always modeled on another language which is generating the things being said, when in fact active statements of their own importance are generated in sign alone.
Well, the sign language of the deaf here, American Sign Language, is completely different from English in style, in grammar, and there is a thing called signed English, which is not a proper language at all, but is a word-for-word transliteration of English into signs. But ASL is a foreign language, and you know, and a wonderfully foreign one, I think, with sort of sensibilities of its own, and different ways of looking at the world.
My own interest in sign began several years ago when a friend of mine, a poet, told me she was learning sign, and in fact she hoped to be able to read her poetry and discover ways in which she could make gestures rhyme and allow words to find puns in signs. And I thought, well, that is, you know, this is a woman, her name was Robin Willoughby, and everything that Robin has ever thought to do amazed me. Mm-hmm. You know, there are some people who just in the course of breathing happen on keyholes or chinks through which they see to another world, and Robin was that for me. I guess later seeing performances by the National Theater of the Deaf moved me greatly, and I know a man who existed for the National Theater of the Deaf as a translator back to the audience. And so it was with considerable pleasure that I heard that you were writing this book, and I looked forward to reading it. Now, there does seem to be a difference between this book and the others. In at least The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, each of the subjects belongs to a society of one. They're in worlds of their own. When I spoke to the person who had worked with the Theater for the Deaf, he told me that he'd learned sign because his sister was deaf. And in fact, he'd been looking at this book, your book, every time he went into a bookstore and feeling growing agitation because he said that his sister's success in the world, she's now apparently an executive at the firm of Hart, Schaffner & Marx, the clothing concern, came because she was forced to learn oralism, mm-hmm. To speak, to articulate. And he felt that this book, perhaps, in its advocating sign as the universal language of the deaf, was not creating the society in which a deaf person hopes to find success, that society is still, he suggested, a speaking society and not a signing one.
Well, I'm not entirely an advocate. My own interest here has been especially in the formation of a visual language and a special linguistic community and culture, and some of the biological basis of this, the all sorts of beautiful adaptations which the brain makes to a visual language. I have seen again and again the horror which can befall a child born deaf who has no language or no competent language. And this leads to the most terrible isolation, as well as to an inability to develop intellectually and humanly. My first concern is that a language of whatever sort, that good language, be accessible to the child and gained by the child in the first 5 years of life. If the child can also learn to speak and lip-read competently, then so much the better. I've nothing against speech. None of the deaf, I think, have anything against speech. But my concern here is mostly with this visual language.
And you point out in the book that years can be spent teaching the prelingual child to speak, years during which nothing is being taught
right.
but the ability to speak. And so you have someone who has learned a language but nothing to express in it.
Exactly. We all acquire language, speech automatically through conversation. The deaf child can't acquire speech in the same way. It has to be a tremendous deliberate labor, and which takes away time from everything else, whereas he can pick up a visual language, and with that, the world.
I wanted to ask you a question a little bit off this subject. Years ago, I had read a book because of a review. It was Three Christs of Ypsilanti.
Oh, yes. Fascinating book.
Fascinating right. book. And the reviewer was Stephen Marcus, who had pointed out that these Christs, these men, each of whom believed he was Christ, each of whom was regarded as terminally schizophrenic, had been, each of them, in institutions for many, many years. And this doctor, Milton Rokish, brought these three men, each of whom believed himself to be Christ, together into the same room. Now, the book is a record of what they said to one another, and Marcus goes on to say that this record of what the Christs have to say to one another sounds oddly like Samuel Beckett's Endgame. Mm-hmm. And he begins to wonder, what is it that both Samuel Beckett and the three Christs are, each of them, logging? What are their antennae picking up that's producing speech of this sort? I found reading The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat a similarly fascinating case, that mm-hmm. it's almost the poetics of these individuals that you're studying. I don't know what the question is.
Somewhere, I think maybe in the preface to Hat, I talk about radical lostness, and I speak of Luria, the great Russian psychologist, as evoking the poetry of radical lostness. But to some extent, many of the people with profound neurological disorders there were in extreme worlds of their own, and could sort of, in a way, send back some messages or some signals, but were so cut off, even though I think they were sort of remarkable, even triumphant or transcendent examples of adaptation, as with Dr. P, who mistook his wife for a hat, who could make no sense of the world visually, but could organize it musically. But even so, it's very difficult to imagine what it's like to be Dr. P, because all of us have been imbuing the world with visual meaning since birth. It's different with the deaf, because really here the adaptation is communal. It's a language. And there's all the difference in the world between an isolated deaf person and a community. For example, yesterday I went to a deaf synagogue in the valley. It was very remarkable, the 200 deaf people there of all ages, and there was a wonderful sense of fraternity and warmth. But I couldn't help thinking, supposing some of those people were in the middle of Wyoming, they would know the most terrible isolation.
Pardon me. This show will be being aired 3 or 4 weeks from now. So could you say that again? And instead of saying yesterday, could you say on Yom Kippur I went to a... Okay. Is that all right? Will you
sure,
be able
right.
to retrieve your train?
I'll try.
Okay.
For example, on Yom Kippur, I went to a synagogue for the deaf in the valley where 200 men and women and children met, all of them signing. It was immensely moving. And there was a wonderful sense of warmth and fraternity and community. None of the people seemed abnormal. But I thought, if any one of them were out there in the middle of Wyoming, how absolutely isolated they would be. So that the... here I'm concerned in an essential way with community, whereas before I think I was concerned in an essential way with individuals.
It's very interesting. I guess, you know, the man who mistook his wife for a hat... There is a kind of Beckett element to these radically lost people. But what about the people, as you say, the deaf, whose despair is perhaps more constantly, if evenly, dulled? Is the solution the creation of a group language? I guess the question is despair ever not an individual thing? Is everyone desperate in a solitary way?
I'm not fully sure that I understand you, but my first association to what you say is to think of a boy whom I describe in the book, an 11-year-old boy who had no language whatever, but who gazed at our mouths and our hands, had a sense, realized that something extraordinary, that meaning was rushing to and fro about him, and reference to a wider world, but he couldn't partake of it. And he wanted to stay at school and learn this. He was afraid to go home, because going home for him meant going home to a vacuum, to a communicational vacuum, where though he loved his parents, he couldn't communicate. All of us need to be thorough, to withdraw, to turn off the radio, to sport the yoke, to shut the door. But we retreat from a community, but we have a community to go back to. What I think I'd never realized until I came to think of the deaf was that you might have people who are otherwise healthy, not brain damaged, not autistic, but who might be cut off from community because there's no language, no common language. And this is why I keep saying there must be language first. Doesn't matter whether it's sign or speech, there must be proper language first. But I may have misunderstood your question.
No, I think you have understood it. But I the question is, you say that in the earlier work you're talking about individuals, here talking about a group. But I'm wondering whether an individual's despair, even if he shares a group's problem, can be, yes, sometimes language comes, but does it come then to express the individuality of that despair, or is the deaf boy lost only in the condition of languagelessness? Does his problem bear... What individualizes, what individuates his unhappiness?
I think that he has no full human relationships with his parents or with anyone else, and that he is not yet a verbal organism. And there have always been fantasies of sometimes romantic ones like The Jungle Book, Kipling's fantasy of life in the jungle. But all the animals speak. All the animals have language. I think Robinson Crusoe has language. There is no fantasy, to my knowledge, which is a fantasy of not having language. I mean, language is itself used to construct the fantasies.
Well, it's very interesting because with Kipling especially, the books are about communication, and I always think that it's an act of generosity on Kipling's part to insert into the Just So stories every so often the phrase, "Oh, my best beloved," mm-hmm. so that the person reading the book is extending endearments written in the book to the child, as if Kipling, fearing that the child hearing the story is being deprived in some way, wants to put into the parent's mouth, "Oh, my best beloved." There really is a great generosity on Kipling's part in that. No, I think that the fantasies about feral children. Now, you have a kind of discursus in this book about
right.
the wolf boy and about...
Right. Yeah, and it's interesting that Harlan Lane, whose book on the history of the deaf started me off, had himself written a book on the wild boy of Avaron, on Victor. Victor, who was found running around on all fours and eating acorns, and... in 1799 and captured and brought to Paris. When I went to UCLA recently, I met Susan Curtis, who wrote a fascinating book about Jeannie, this modern-day wild child who had been found locked up in an apartment in Southern California. There's a horror and a fascination about a child who has been denied human culture, and possibly also an imagined romantic feeling, as one has in the Just So stories, where it's Kipling's fantasy to have a child uncontaminated by human culture, but in fact it's an unmitigated disaster, because human nature is not complete in itself. It's not complete without culture. Maybe animal nature is complete without culture, but we are historical beings and we are linguistic beings, whether we like it or not. I think I myself hadn't fully realized this until I came to deal with the subject. And my previous works, in a sense, were on visual powers and motor powers. This is the first time I'd really come to grips with language and culture. And interestingly, this was what Bob Silvers, the editor of the New York Review of Books, said to me when he gave me Harlan Lane's book to review. He said, "You've never really thought about language. This will make you, and from a perspective you never dreamed of."
It has been a singular review in that it's inspired quite a few writers to things that grew beyond articles to book length. I'm curious, why is it that fairy tales and so much folklore is created around the loss of a sense? In many cases, the folklore of a culture is all about deprivation, being, you know, an unwanted stepchild, or, you know, strewing crumbs that then the mm-hmm. birds eat so you are not found. There is, I guess, in a sense, in your work, the feeling of the work having to get to a child in an ensorcelled state and then find a rescue that will not violate that state.
I certainly felt that somewhat with Awakenings, where some of the mythological images of being turned to stone and falling into a long sleep were, you know, were, became reality. And I sometimes have a funny feeling that a lot of my work is at the intersection of fable and reality in this way. I suppose that even if one loses a child for 5 minutes, the whole moral landscape of profound lostness can rise up for one. Parents who have a deaf child may feel in terror of losing their child. Sometimes they even feel in terror of losing their child to the deaf community. Although the deaf community is the greatest resource a deaf child has and is entirely giving and enriching and never taking. I suppose there must be impulses to lose and be lost. But I agree, these are universal, and I think some of these, you know, must have been behind my own desire to get into this more. Something very primal was brought up, and I had a long period of being separated from my own parents, being evacuated when the war broke out, and I give the name of that school to one of the schools here in this book.
I have a final question. I'm very curious to ask Oliver Sacks, author of Seeing Voices, A Journey into the World of the Deaf, if you were to recommend three works of fiction that you feel are not well known, are your own secret pleasures, what would they be?
I don't know that I read that amount of fiction. I love all H.G. Wells. I love all early H.G. Wells. I don't know how well known this is in America now, but the Time Machine is a work I deeply love. I like Turgenev. I like the quietness of Turgenev, especially a late Turgenev like Smoke. Maybe some Benson, maybe some E.F. Benson.
Lucia?
Why not?
Why not? There needs to be a party at the end of every day. This is Michael Silverblatt. I've been talking to Oliver Sacks, author of Seeing Voices, A Journey into the World of the Deaf, published recently by the University of California Press. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Bob Carlson. Thank you for being with us, Oliver. And
it's been very, very nice. Thank you.
Thank you. And join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books, to the land of ice and snow in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with Book of the Mouse, Mouse Time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.